Late Summer Gardening Advice. It's the time of year when we are enjoying the bounty of our vegetable garden, or maybe cursing the woodchuck that destroyed it. How's your garden this summer? This stretch of humid, rainy weather has certainly been good for vegetables such as spinach, fruits like blackberries, and lots of perennial flowers. It has also been good for some of the pests we dread every year. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What questions do you have about your garden? Call us, tweet us, or send an email. And we invite you to post a picture of your garden on our Facebook page. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. How does your garden look this time of year? Are you dealing with pests and diseases? Or are you harvesting some nice, ripe vegetables and making beautiful flower arrangements? Well, if you're looking for answers to your gardening questions, we have them for you. In the studio with me, Pamela Hargest. She is horticulture professional with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension based in Cumberland County. And joining us on the line, Andy Brand. He is plant curator with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. As always, we want to hear from you. What is doing well or not so well in your garden? What invasives are you looking for answers to your questions about? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I don't know about you, Pamela, but this feels like it's been a more humid, sort of more damp summer than usual. What has this kind of weather been good for, and what has it been not so good for?
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit rough on some of our some favorite summer vegetables like tomatoes and peppers. Of course, we want to have enough rain so we don't have to irrigate as much or water our plants, but we also can run into fungal issues with some of our plants, like early blight with tomatoes. So I would say for people, just keep an eye out on their plants this time of year and see what's going on, because you might find some blight popping up, and just making sure that you're allowing enough air to flow through your plants so that you don't come across those fungal issues.
So you're thinking people may have to deal with issues this year that they don't usually have. If you've had a vegetable garden for a long time, for example, you might have some different issues this year.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we definitely have that period of humidity that comes in August, but it seems like it's come earlier this year and definitely a little bit more damp than usual. So some of those things you might see coming in mid-August might be arriving a little early in August. So just being aware of that and planning for it is always good.
Great. Andy, what has the effect of this weather been on all the flowers at the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens?
The flowers have been actually pretty spectacular this year. Despite the lack of rain that we've had here at the garden, things are still looking really nice. And a day like today with the lack of sunlight, I think the colors are really especially bright and vivid. There's incredible numbers of things in flower. We have suffered a little bit with the past humid weather on a few things that are notoriously prone to powdery mildew, like monardas, and some of the phlox have shown some powdery mildew, probably due to the high humidity we've had the past few days. But, you know, there's a lot of things in flower, from annuals to perennials to trees and shrubs, are still flowering away out there.
Oh, great. Pam, I know that it seems like it's still the middle of summer. It's the first week in August, the second week in August. You're sitting here with a little bit of a down jacket on, though.
I am. And part of it is just because, you know, my office is really cold in the summertime. And I'm just like, want to have the option of putting on an extra layer.
But you're also thinking about fall and winter in the garden, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like, especially with vegetables, you're thinking ahead to the next season because there's a lot of planning required. So, like, I just did a season extension workshop last week and getting people thinking about fall and winter production. Because this is a good time of year to get things planted, to make sure you have your seeds lined up for what you might want to put in your garden. It's a good time of year to order garlic, unless you're someone who goes to the Common Ground Fair and gets your garlic there. But a lot of companies like Vedco and Johnny's are selling garlic this time of year, and they often sell out too. So if you want a special variety, it's good to get it ahead of time.
When do you recommend people put their garden in for next spring, their garlic in for next spring?
Yeah, so usually it's not till October. It'll be mid to late October, but everybody loves growing garlic. So a lot of times those favorite varieties will sell out. So it's always good to just be thinking ahead.
Andy, what kind of planning are you doing there? Are you already thinking about fall bulbs?
We are, yeah. The bulb orders are going in for just fall, but also for spring, believe it or not, which seems crazy. It's so far away. But, you know, temperatures, they're going to start moderating. We see things in the garden flowering now, like, you know, the goldenrods are starting to come into flower, Joe Pye weeds, you know, things you associate with late summer, early fall, they're starting to come into flower. So you get the feeling that, you know, the seasons will be changing before we know it, and we'll have pumpkin and cooler temperatures coming on in a short time.
Andy, I know a big hit this summer at the Coastal Maine Botanical Garden has been the butterfly and moth exhibit. And I know a lot of people are really concerned about the monarch butterflies. What kind of advice do you have for people who would like to be thinking about adding more pollinators to their garden? Is it the same advice for everywhere in Maine, or different plants for different parts of the state?
I would say, you know, when we think about monarchs, obviously the plants that come to mind are any plants with the Asclepias genus, you know, milkweeds. That's what you want to plant for monarchs, because that's what their caterpillars will be feeding on and enjoying as they grow bigger and bigger before they pupate and form the chrysalis. So the more milkweed we can plant, whether it's swamp milkweed, the butterfly weed, which is that lovely bright orange one that loves full sun, or if you have a field where you don't mow it and you have the common milkweed, that, you know, that kind of spreads, you know, anything that we can leave for them, especially the milkweed, is great. But plant other nectar sources as well, for not just the monarchs, but for other pollinators, other bees, other butterflies. You know, and you want to make sure you have a continuous bloom throughout spring, summer, into early fall, particularly early fall. You know, when the monarchs are thinking about migrating south, they need as much energy and nutrition as they can get. So if we can plant flowers like Joe Pye weed, Solidago, or the goldenrods, things that they can get valuable nectar out of and nutrition, then they'll have the energy they need to fly the, you know, thousands of miles south to Mexico to spend the winter.
All right. Pamela, I know you take a lot of calls at UMaine Cooperative Extension. What are people calling about right now?
Well, actually, with this damp weather, we've been getting a lot of calls about mushrooms, about, you know, different types of mushrooms popping up in people's backyards. And so, you know, there are different questions. Some people want to identify them. Some people are worried about how harmful they are.
Especially if their dog eats them.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you have, you know, a younger kid or a pet, then that's really of concern. But, you know, we always encourage people to look up some different guides that might help them identify them, and definitely not try to harvest anything that they don't know what it is.
And Andy, what about native plants? Are there certain plants that you, I know there's a lot of interest in that, that you recommend to a beginning starting to be advanced gardener?
Native plants, yeah. You know, right now natives are really popular to kind of attract biodiversity to someone's yard, to increase the number of insects and birds and other types of wildlife to your yard. And there's so many great natives. I mean, a couple have come to mind that I just saw as I was walking the gardens today. Clethra alnifolia, our native summer sweet, which is a beautiful late season summer flowering shrub that grows typically around kind of damp, moist areas, pond edges, stream edges, has wonderful fragrant white clusters of flowers that are loved by butterflies and all assortments of types of bees and flies and things. Another perennial I would recommend are any of the mountain mints, pycnanthemums. They have very kind of minty fragrance to the foliage if you crush it in your hands, but they have these tiny little flowers that are just like magnets for honeybees and other types of pollinators. any shrubs, native shrubs like native viburnums that provide fruit late in the season. Birds, you know, it's valuable nutrition for birds. You know, our arrowwood viburnum, things like that are fantastic to supply food for birds and other wildlife.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And also, we invite you to post a picture of your garden on our Facebook page today. We're going to celebrate the season. We're going to start here with an email from Mimi. And she writes, I would like to share what seems to me an amazing new discovery, which may be as exciting to some listeners as it is for me. My lawn has been unmown since this time last year, so all the weeds that grow there are now lush and tall. This makes them quite easy to hand pull, including the entire root systems. All through my lawn, there are vast patches of gill over the ground, aka ground ivy, aka creeping Charlie. And given the extreme difficulty of successfully removing this dreadful invasive, I had long ago given up on the idea of ever ridding my lawn of it. However, it turns out when the lawn is not cut, ground ivy comes out easily, roots and all. Part of this is due to the way it's not tightly entwined with the surrounding grass. I simply hook my fingers under the stems and pull up. So, Andy, what do you think of her strategy?
I think that's great. I think that's a smart move. And I would also recommend doing that to some extent, but also before you go to pull the weeds, is if you can do it right after a rain where we've had, you know, good soaking rain, so the ground is moist, the weeds tend to be easier to pull out than as if it's been, you know, the ground is parched and very, very dry, like, and it's become almost like concrete. I would suggest that. But yeah, I always recommend that people don't mow their lawns as much as they tend to want to. Not just for ease of pulling weeds, but also a lot of those plants that are in your lawn that aren't grass are homes to and supply food for other types of wildlife.
We'll go to Brianna calling from New Gloucester. Hi, Brianna. Go ahead.
Hi. I was calling because you mentioned the warm and wet weather this year, which has been great in our garden for many, many things. However, I think what we're dealing with our squash, particularly the spaghetti squash and pumpkin, is called fusarium or fungal crown rot, possibly. I've been reading up a little bit about it, and I just wanted to know what your experts had to say. I guess it can be devastating. I guess it can stain your soil for a few years. What do we do?
Okay, Pamela.
Yeah, so if it's something that can stay in your soil for a few years, I would probably recommend even uprooting the plant because you don't want to encourage those spores to keep spreading in your soil. I know that's kind of disheartening after putting in a lot of work into, you know, growing the plant, but a lot of times that is just your best option thinking for next year. Or if you feel, well, it's hard with crown rot, but if you're able to, in some cases, you can kind of cut out some of the leaves that are affected and trying to remove it. Or, you know, you could even just wait until the end of the season and just make sure you dispose of the plant completely and not let it stay there in your garden or your compost pile. Just trying to break that cycle of the spores spreading is a big thing you can do.
All right. Well, good luck, Brianna. An email from Elizabeth. I have a lovely, thriving Elizabeth magnolia planted 6 years ago. It had a gorgeous display of flowers this spring, and it's blooming again, which seems odd. Any thoughts? Leaves are lush, and tree does not appear stressed. Andy.
The magnolias will notoriously do that for, I don't know the exact reason, but I used to work for a nursery. We used to have magnolias rebloom, like, you know, sporadically in the later part of the summer. They put out a few flowers, so it's wonderful to see. You know, you get a second burst of these, particularly with Elizabeth, these lovely lemon yellow flowers. The downside is you may not have as many flowers then come next spring. It means that, seems to me, the tree is healthy and happy, and it just, in my experience, there's many types of magnolias tend to do this and will throw out a few additional flowers later in the summer rather than just keep them all till April and May.
All right, an email from Arthur. We seem to have an overabundance of Asian garden beetles. They wipe out carrots, beets, and other root crops by eating the greens as they sprout. Any suggestions?
Yeah, that's always a problem in gardens. That's interesting, though, carrots and beets. Usually it's other vegetables that are more affected. But in some ways, I wouldn't be too worried about your root crops because oftentimes you find that by picking the leaves off, you'll get a bigger root. So the plant is able to put more energy into the actual carrot or the beet. You obviously need some leaves because you need your plant to be able to photosynthesize and produce that food that the plant needs. But I would just play it by ear. If you just leave what's there, and as long as there's a few leaves, you should be fine, and you might end up with a larger root.
All right, we're going to go to Daniel calling from Calais. Hi, Daniel. How are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm playing with the phone here.
Oh, that's okay. Go ahead.
Well, I'm in Calais behind Main Street. And I've created what I think is a beautiful little urban garden. I have three types of tomatoes, jalapenos, bell peppers, sunflowers, and pumpkins. And then a bunch of potted flowers to draw in the bees.
That's great. Do you have a question for our guests, or are you just saying that in Calais things are going well this year?
Yeah, we've had drought conditions since the beginning of June. The clouds seem to go north of us all the time. So I've been having to water everything every day. And I have no sign of bugs, but everything's doing well. I'm bringing in hundreds of cherry tomatoes right now.
That's
and
great.
I just wanted to say, yeah, things are going well in Calais. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. Yeah, we're doing well with our smaller tomatoes, too. Is that?
Yeah, this is a great time of year for cherries, and they're so prolific for usually the first few weeks of August. And, you know, we'll start dwindling down towards the third, last week of August. But, yeah, this is a great time to pick up those sun golds at the farmer's market.
All right, Daniel, thanks for your call. A question from Mike in Caribou. I seem to have an infestation of crabgrass. Any tips on how to eradicate it? Mike, you are not alone. And Andy, I'm going to give you this one.
Oh, yeah, that's tough. Yeah, I don't have a really great explanation of how to get rid of them, to get rid of crabgrass, especially if you have it extensive in your lawn. What I've done in my yard is just, you know, don't let it go to seed, obviously. Try to get new grass to grow before that comes in, so seed earlier. You know, Pamela, I don't know if you have any suggestions, too, but it for crabgrass.
Yeah. If someone's concerned about their lawn, I would recommend them getting a soil test because sometimes depending on your pH and the organic matter, more invasive things like that can take off under those conditions. But this is also a really great time of year to seed some more diversity into your lawn or even some different grass seeds because the soil is nice and warm. Generally, it's a little less weed pressure, but if you have crabgrass, then that might mean, you know, you have a little bit more going on there. But just trying to overseed and promote a healthy diversity of plants, something that could maybe overcome the crabgrass.
And when you say overseed, do you mean go in and dig it out and put some fresh seed down?
Yeah, putting fresh seed down. And, you know, sometimes you can throw in a little bit of loam or compost just to help protect the seeds a little bit and provide some moisture.
All right. Well, we are going to go to a break. We're talking to our gardening experts today on Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. And also post your picture of your garden if you would like. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do BCM Environmental and Land Law of Northern New England, helping landowners, farmers, and governments problem solve. nhlandlaw.com. And the Alzheimer Association's Walk to End Alzheimer's, with 7 locations from York Beach to Fort Kent. Details at alz.org/walk.
A new novel about the war in Iraq has already been sold in 8 languages, and it won't even be published until later this month. The first-time author is a vet. We could only interview him by phone.
This call is from a federal prison.
All right, good, we got that out of the way.
I'm Ari Shapiro, a story of war and its aftermath, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. In this digital age, there is plenty of information everywhere. But don't you sometimes wish you could find exactly what you want? This is how our community calendar works. You search for the date, location, venue, and/or type of event you're looking for, and there it is. The community calendar has hundreds of concerts, exhibits, lectures, and then some from all around the state. And it's always open for new listings should you want to get the word out about your event. The community calendar, another public service from Maine Public. Online at mainepublic.org.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, answering your gardening questions. Joining me today, Pamela Hargest, who's a horticulture expert with UMaine Cooperative Extension. And on the line, Andy Brand, a plant curator with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, we were talking about lawns and crabgrass. And I wanted to ask Pamela about the idea of seeding your lawn, not just with different grasses, but maybe also with clover.
Yeah, absolutely. Clover is a great substitute for a lawn. And it actually provides food source as well, the flowers for a lot of different pollinators. And clover has a deeper root system, too, so it'll often be able to withstand usually the dry summers that we get here. So just, you know, doing a variety of things is always a good idea. So your chances are better that something will do well. And clover is definitely one of my favorites to plant.
Yeah, I would second that, too, especially white clover. I love it. I've got it all over my lawn. I mow my lawn every couple of weeks, and occasionally you cut off the flowers, but then the white clover just continuously produces flowers that are just loved by so many different bees and other insects. It's a fantastic plant to mix in with your lawn grasses, I think, too.
Andrea on Facebook asks, some of my impatiens that were spectacular just a few weeks ago have fallen prey to powdery mildew. After removing them from the containers, is it okay to replace them with begonias with the same soil? Andy?
I would think so. I mean, I've actually had similar things happen with impatiens, and I've taken them out and replaced them with other types of annuals and had very little trouble with, you know, the powdery mildew moving on to other things. So I would say to go ahead and do that. I haven't had experience with begonias, but with other annuals, after the impatiens have succumbed to powdery mildew, they've done just fine. I have removed any of the spent foliage and a little bit of the topsoil that's right at the very surface of the pots, just to try to reduce any potential disease problems.
Well, that's a great advice, because I know a lot of people use their pots throughout the year and maybe replace the plants a couple times. So is that sort of your general practice, Andy, to remove the root ball and maybe an inch of surface soil?
I have, and I haven't seen any troubles. I mean, you wouldn't want to do that if you happen to run into any soil-borne diseases. Then you definitely want to get rid of the soil completely and possibly even think about, you know, cleaning the pot with, I don't know, maybe even like a really mild bleach solution or something to kill any kind of disease spores you may have in that container if it's a soil-borne issue.
All right. We're going to go to, let's see, Megan calling from Monmouth. Hi, Megan. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much. I just wanted to plug in a local business. They're right in Monmouth. They're called Our Funny Farm. It's owned by a couple, Don and Hollis Smith. And we were talking about native plants earlier. They've got a selection of native plants. They're extremely knowledgeable. So I highly recommend everyone and all the listeners stop in. They're open Friday and Saturday, 8 to 5.
All right, Megan, thanks for calling. We'll go to Anne with an email. She writes, I grow cucumbers in my greenhouse, and my question is, should I water the foliage when I'm watering the greenhouse? I always direct the water to the roots, but I'm wondering if it's good for the foliage to have a coating of water. I always water in the morning, so I'm not concerned with water laying on the leaves during the night.
Yeah, so I would definitely direct your watering towards the roots. It's generally a good rule of thumb that you don't want to get your leaves of anything, really, whether it's a lettuce or tomatoes or cucumbers. You don't want moisture to sit there for too long. It's great that you water in the morning because that's always ideal. It gives it enough time to dry out through the day, but you'll probably increase your chances of some different fungal issues if you water the foliage as well.
All right, let's see here. We have an email from Solange. Speaking of monarchs, invasive black swallowwort is in pod stage now. The pods look like milkweed, and if monarchs lay eggs on it, the larvae will starve. This plant is insidious and will strangle other plants. Andy, I have to confess, I don't quite understand Solange's message, but I'm passing it on thinking that you will.
A little bit, yeah. So black swallowwort is a highly invasive weed that is spreading throughout the state. I've noticed it wherever I've been. The pods do resemble milkweed pods, and female monarchs are fooled into laying their eggs on the plant, thinking it's a type of milkweed that is going to be okay. And the eggs hatch, but unfortunately the caterpillars are unable to feed on it successfully and continue to grow. So they die. As she said, they basically starve to death because they can't feed on this plant. And it's very, very tough to eradicate. You can't just go in and pull it out. It runs with, you know, these underground rhizomes, and it just trails everywhere, climbs up things. I've seen some really extensive patches of it, but it's one that unfortunately is not good for our monarchs because they do get fooled into laying their eggs on it, and the caterpillars die.
And so how does one know if you've got this on your property?
So it has a vining character to it, not like going to grow up like a wisteria would, but it does vine up, you know, nearby plants and shrubs. It has a narrow, dark green, pointed leaf. The flowers tend to be these small, kind of maroonish brown, star-shaped flowers. And then the pods, if you recall what a milkweed pod looks like, they're kind of a rounded, plump, more elongated, I should say, pointed pod. And then they open up just like a milkweed pod does, and you get this fluffy seed that is dispersed everywhere by the wind.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, thank you, Solange, for that heads up. We're going to go to Dick calling from Bangor. Hi, Dick. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm after 30 years, I've sort of gotten back to gardening over to the community garden in Bangor, and they want it to be organic, which is good. And but I was wondering, as I stared at my squash and cucumbers and a couple of beans, what I could use to control cucumber beetles, Japanese beetles, and maybe squash bugs or flea beetle.
That's a really hard question to answer, because those beetles are often really difficult to get rid of. Usually what I try to recommend for people is to scout for them early so that you can try to stay on top of the population while it's smaller, because they tend to explode pretty quickly. Actually, there's a few things that have worked for me. I've kind of gone around my cucumber plants for the cucumber beetles with a jar and soapy water, and I'll just knock them into the jar. So if you have a small area, that can work. I've also heard of people taking a little vacuum with them and literally vacuuming them up, which
like
can,
a little dustbuster.
Yeah, a little dustbuster, and that actually can work pretty well. So those are some like non-chemical options. I'm assuming a lot of community gardens are organic. I think just, you know, to kind of please everyone, and you know, it's good practices. So I guess just making sure, if you wanted to use something, that they don't have any additional restrictions on organic pesticides. But definitely be aware of what you're using. I don't know of anything that works really well on any of those pests, so it might not even be worth it to use something and just try to do the the soapy water or something like that for now might be a good option for you. But checking with your community garden first before you use anything is a good idea.
And Pamela, would it be a good idea to try to enlist the partnership of your fellow gardeners? Because if you've picked all the Japanese beetles and cucumber beetles off your plants, but your neighbors have not.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a big problem with community gardens. Everyone has to be on board for it to really work because everyone's so close together. So I know a lot of community gardens have work days, so trying to schedule something where everyone comes out and can help stay on top of some of those pests is always a good way to go and creates less work for you individually.
All right, Dick, thanks for your call. We'll go to Margaret in Orland. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Oh, I just walked out of the garden dismayed. I thought I was getting away with not having any tomato hornworms, but there was one plant showing the beginnings of it, and I couldn't for the life of me. I spent 15-20 minutes searching with my eyes through all that plant, and I couldn't find it, and I couldn't imagine where it had gone. I mean, they don't travel very fast, do they? And my question is, should I do they start at the top and then work down? In other words, which direction should I be looking? Or maybe they have no directionality at all. Does anybody know about their habits?
Yeah, so you are right in that they don't move that fast. So usually people are able to stay on top of them just by, you know, even if you see the signs of them being on your plant, you can usually find them in the next few days. I wouldn't say they really move in any particular order, especially this time of the year, because most tomato plants are pretty mature, so you might find them kind of anywhere on the plant. So it's tough. It's really frustrating when you also see what it's doing and you can't find it and you know exactly what it looks like. But they also blend in very well. So I would say just try to spend the next few days looking for it a little bit more. I'm sure you'll come across it soon.
And when you say it, so just one.
Yeah, that's assuming that it's just one, but it could be a few. So that's a good point. And, you know, keeping your eyes out for that. And we do have the parasitic wasps that can lay eggs on it. And that's another good natural control. That's not necessarily something you can count on. But if you do come across it and it looks like it has a bunch of white eggs surrounding it, then just leave it because that means those wasps are going to keep spreading. And that's what you want.
Good luck, Margaret. Yeah, go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add, we had experienced them here in the gardens, and another gardening friend of mine had some, and I looked endlessly the other day, and I think our experience is they may have even wandered off to pupate. So they may be, if you're lucky, they may be done feeding right now. So maybe that could be an explanation why you're not seeing them, because I know the ones we had earlier have disappeared. And are no longer being seen. So
that's good news in the short term.
Right, in the short term, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Thanks, Margaret. We'll move to Carol, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Carol, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I have swamp milkweed in my garden, but I was recently told by someone that the monarchs only lay their eggs on common milkweed. So I'm wondering if I need to try to find that for next year.
Oh, no, I think you're wrong, Andy. Swamp milkweed's good, right?
Yeah, any of the milkweed. Swamp milkweed's fine. The ones we have here in our butterfly and moth house at the botanical gardens, they're devoured and just completely stripped of all their foliage by monarchs. So, yeah, leave your swamp milkweed in the garden. It's great for them to feed on both the nectar and the foliage for the caterpillars. You shouldn't have any problems at all. They'll be happy with it.
Thanks, Carol. There you go. We'll go to Esta calling from Damariscotta. Hi, Esta. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was asking about purslane. I've been, for the last few years, all of my beds are just covered with purslane.
Okay. What do you say to that, Pamela?
Well, purslane is pretty easy to get up. The roots aren't so large that it makes it hard to pull out. First of all, you can eat purslane. So if you were interested in eating it, it's actually very nutritious, and that could be a way to get rid of it. but that's also a lot of work harvesting it. So using some kind of long-handed tool, because bending over is a lot of work, to just kind of scrape under the surface of the plant to get up the root. And if you do this on like a sunny day, then, you know, the plant will be dug up and you don't even have to pick it up. It can just fry in the sun if it's left on the soil.
So you mean like a hoe?
Yeah, like a hoe, or there are some other, you know, newer tools out there that are great, like a small wire weeder or co-linear hoe works really well. But yeah, anything like that would be work very well for you with purslane.
Good luck, Esther. We're going to take another quick break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
On the next Speaking in Maine, another installment in our Champlain Institute series.
The United States of America is no longer the world's model of democracy, and that's a very alarming fact for us.
Ted Widmer is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. He joins us at College of the Atlantic to address the question, is democracy failing? That's on the next Speaking in Maine, Monday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the co-founder of Sire Records, Seymour Stein, who discovered Talking Heads and the Ramones and signed Madonna and Ice-T. Also, Jim Gavin, creator of the new AMC series Lodge 49, about a bereaved surfer named Dud who stumbles upon a declining fraternal order like the Elks. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 right here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about gardening and answering your questions. Joining me, Pamela Hargest with UMaine Cooperative Extension and Andy Brand with Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Emily on Facebook writes, for the past 3 years, I've had caterpillars that have ruined one of my Annabelle hydrangea plants. I try to pick off the affected leaves and throw them away, but they continue to damage the flowering buds and caterpillars return the next year no matter what I do. Is there anything else I can do in fall or early spring to eradicate this pest? This season it began affecting the neighboring Annabelle plant as well. Andy?
Yeah, I was waiting for you to call me.
You didn't want to answer this one?
Yeah. It's a tough one. No, it's hard. If I think what she's talking about, referring to the caterpillars that pull the terminal leaves together and they pull them all together and form a little house for themselves to hide in as they're chewing away at the foliage. And what we used to do, it's time consuming, was literally go out and pull them off, break them off at the terminals to get rid of them and then just dispose of them that way. I'm sure there are some chemical controls that could be used as well, but I'm not a big proponent of that either. I used to just spend the time taking them off by hand with the main control that we did for that type of an insect, if that's the one that she's referring to.
And what kind of insect did you think it was?
It's a caterpillar of a moth. I don't know the exact name, but it pulls all the leaves in the terminus of each branch together, and it looks like a little, almost, you know, rounded ball at the terminal of each branch. And they're easy to control because you can just go in and pop them off, but they will come back. You just have to be very persistent is what we found to get rid of them. And they do show up year after year, unfortunately. And I would just clean up the debris around them in the fall. May help some as well.
Great. We're going to go to David from Wayne. His question is about broccoli. He says, mine started one. But now has gotten all ratty, and the head hasn't developed yet. Anything I can do?
Yeah, so if this was planted in the spring, usually our broccoli by now will already have its head form. There have been times, though, where I planted broccoli in the spring and planted it a little too late and left it for the fall, and it actually worked out pretty well. But this is kind of the time of year where you can have a lot of pest problems with your brassicas, but you may want to consider replanting some broccoli. That will actually do a lot better for the fall. Fall is a great time for brassicas. There's a lot less pest pressure because of the cold weather moving in, and definitely a cold weather loving plant. But if you didn't want to do that, I would just, you know, let it stay there and maybe give it some more time. And maybe it was a broccoli variety that does take a little bit longer.
We'll go to Therese calling from Richmond. Hi, Therese. Go ahead.
Hi. This is a lawn question. I have a very invasive ground-growing plant, geranium leaf-like, about the size of a quarter, and I swear if you take one little tiny leaf and drop it somewhere else, it spreads. Don't know what it is. Very aromatic.
Do you know what it is, Andy?
Yeah, of course, the name has left my brain at the moment. I know exactly what she's talking about. It trails. It's very, very low.
Is it a problem? Should she try to get rid of it or just mow it?
It will continue to spread. So if she can, it's usually pretty easy. You tug on one end and it'll pull up in big mats if you can get to it. The plant I'm thinking about. It's got tiny little like bluish flowers, I believe, or whitish blue flower. But it will continue. It kind of roots in, you know, at every node as it goes and just keeps spreading. But it's literally like a mat form. Unfortunately, I can't think of the name of it. But I will, if before the end of the show, I'll hopefully come up with a name for you.
And Teresa, does that sound right? Little white and blue flowers?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So, Andy, never mind the name. Just try your best to pull up the trailing vine in clumps.
I would. Yeah, it should peel up. I've had it too. And if you get a hold of it, it's usually pretty easy to pull out. And it comes up in these big, long strands of leaves. Yeah.
All right. Good luck, Therese. An email from Deej. I planted hills for butternut squash, delicata, pumpkins, and cukes at the same time. The squash is coming on great. Definitely evidence of produce, but not so much as in nothing with the cukes and pumpkins. Any ideas?
Oh, man. Well, it could be some other environmental factor going on. But it sounds like you did what you should do. I mean, if you're not using any kind of trellis system, it's nice to do a hill. It's not as necessary for cucumbers, but definitely for pumpkins and our winter squashes like butternut squash. I would take a look around to see if there's any other things going on with your garden, because sometimes you'd be surprised by, you know, maybe it's in a slightly different location than your other plants, and that's why it's not doing as well. The light water conditions could be the soil. You know, usually for us, we always make sure people do soil tests before they plant, because it could have something to do with what's going on in your soil.
Seems like often the answer to the question starts with get a soil test.
It does. That's always where we start, and because it gives you a good baseline of what you're working with, and we give really good recommendations for how to make changes to your soil based off of what you want to grow.
And when you say we, you mean the Humane Cooperative Extension.
I do. Yes, that's exactly what I mean.
Okay, we'll go to Kim calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, my question is a little unusual. I contracted with Garbage to Garden this year to put in a couple raised beds for me in a community plot that I've been part of for a long time. And, oh, my gosh, it's Jurassic Park in there. I have never seen produce like this. And I called them and they said it's their normal compost and topsoil. But I just am really wondering, is it a lot of nitrogen? Is there some element in there that really we're in there every couple of days. you know, we need a machete to get rid of some of it.
Kim, I think it sounds like a pretty good problem to have.
That's what I was going to say, too. Yeah.
I'm mystified because I've never had produce like this. It just keeps coming. And I'm wondering, you know, is there something special that I didn't know about that I should be adding so that I you know, have you ever heard of this? Is there...
Well, it's definitely generally a good thing. I think most gardeners would agree. Well, the good news is, you know, it sounds like it probably was pretty high quality compost. So, you know, the compost will break down over time or continue to break down and nutrients will become available to your plants. So hopefully next year when you plant, you might have more kind of normal size, less Jurassic Park feel to vegetables. So I would see what happens next year in that same spot with the same soil, because it might just be that, you know, like you just said, it's kind of had a lot of nutrients available at the time for your plants.
All right, Kim, good luck to you. We have a tweet from Nissa. We have a 50-plus-year-old succulent rock garden on the Pemaquid Peninsula that has been neglected for decades. Any tips on bringing it back to its former glory? There are still quite a few succulents going strong. What an interesting question. Never had that question before on our gardening show, Andy. I didn't know you could have an outdoor succulent garden in Maine.
Yeah, I'm curious as what exactly, when she says succulents, if it's things like hens and chicks, and or if they actually are some of the hardy cacti and things like that. I think if it's overgrown, for mainly a lot of the succulents, yeah, you need to get in there and open up and get them as much sunlight as possible. I prefer more sun than shade. If that's an issue, you know, it's going to be a very tedious job getting in there and weeding around them to reduce competition and kind of open up the area again. I mean, I think it's certainly doable, but it's going to be a tedious, time-consuming task for sure. But, you know, make sure, and no drainage problems have, you know, drainage hasn't changed. So, like, water is being dumped into that area. They tend to prefer, you know, drier feet, particularly in the winter months. So just, you know, make sure that that's, there's still the drainage is there that they require. But, you know, open it up for sunlight and weed them out. And I think, you know, in a few years, I think you could definitely restore it, you know, much better than it is right now. It sounds like it's pretty overgrown, but I think it's doable for sure.
All right. Thanks, Nissa, for your tweet. We'll go to Sherry calling from Wayne. Hi, Sherry. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I love your show and listen to it all the time.
Thank you.
I'm calling about the question about how do we find those pesky tomato hornworms. And I got a tip from a farmer friend of mine recently. In fact, I found a really big one the other day, and I couldn't find any others, even though I knew they had to be there. And he said, go out with a black light after dark, and you will find more. And indeed, I did. I found four more, including very small ones, about an inch long.
Oh,
so
okay.
I just wanted to pass that along.
Thank you. Good tip. Have you heard that one, Pamela, a black light at night?
I actually haven't, but I'm not too surprised. That sounds like a great tip to me.
All right. Thanks, Sherry. Never know what you'll find.
That's a great point, because we just got done here at the Botanic Gardens. We had Sam Jaffe from New Hampshire from the Caterpillar Lab just did a whole program, and he actually has a UV flashlight, and that's how he finds a lot of the caterpillars. He goes out at night with this UV flashlight and shines it on trees and shrubs, and a lot of the caterpillars will kind of glow, and you'll pick them off real easily. So,
And the caterpillars think they're hiding at night. That's great. Thanks, Sherry.
Makes them shine, yeah.
Yeah. We'll go to Joan, who's calling from Skowhegan. Hi, Joan. Go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering, I've had poison ivy moving into one of my yards, and it's in an area that I can't mow. So I was wondering, any other ways to get rid of poison ivy?
Oh, goodness. Andy?
Oof. Well, the way I usually do it is I literally put on a long pair of gloves. It sounds terrible, you know, like a thick, like dishwasher gloves. And if it's not too extensive, get in there and take it out by hand. I have occasionally had to resort to chemicals and rather than spraying broadcast over the plants, I'll find where it's coming out of the ground, cut it, and then just paint the stump of the plant. So it's very limited amount of chemical, and it's you know, pinpoint where you apply it, and then it'll kill out the root, you know, kill the root system. If you want to go that route.
Andy, our engineer, Nikki, says that goats eat poison ivy. Have you ever heard of somebody utilizing goats?
I've heard people use goats to clear a lot of fields that are reverting back to you know, woods, and poison ivy is one that they will eat. Sure, raspberries, you know, all the brambles. They've got mouths of steel, it seems. They can eat.
They're amazing. Joan, good luck to you. You know, Pam, what should people be doing this time of year to, you know, I know a lot of people plant their vegetable garden in the springtime with a lot of enthusiasm. By now, it's sort of like, yeah. What to do to get ready for a good fall and for next year?
Yeah, so it also kind of depends on if you want the season to keep going. I know some people this time of year, it's a little overwhelming, so they're okay with not doing any vegetables for the fall. But even if you're not doing vegetables for the fall, it's always good to have something on your garden soil. You don't really want to leave the soil bare. So you could even, you know, this time of year, it's a good idea to add compost. You could do a cover crop or something in just your small area, putting down some straw or something to mulch your garden, have it covered. If you want to plant something, it's, you know, we're kind of getting into that season. It's a good idea to start planting your carrots and beets for the fall. You could do kale, salad mix. There's a lot of different options out there, turnips. So it's kind of exciting. For me, I always love extending the season as much as I can. So it's really fun to kind of plan, you know, what am I going to have out
and
there?
And it's not too late to plant carrots by seed?
No, it's not too late. You know,
well,
we're getting close to, you know, the deadline,
close.
I'd say.
Okay. Well, that's going to be our last word. And I'm sorry if we were not able to get to one of your questions. The hour always goes so quickly when we have our gardening experts. The voice you just heard, Pamela Hargest, a horticulturalist with the University of Maine Cooperative Extension based in Cumberland County, and Andy Brand, the plant curator for Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Tomorrow on the program, journalist Colin Woodard and why he believes our current political divide is deeper than the urban versus rural voter divide we hear about. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.